It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. It's the time of year families and friends gather around the table, for good or for not so good. Today, some tales from home. New York Times restaurant critic Ruth Reichel tells us stories from her family meals. Sitting down to the family table of her childhood had all the allure of walking through a minefield. Ruth's mother was taste blind, couldn't tell if food was spoiled. Such are the strange things that shape food careers. The Stearns take us to T, South Dakota. Cheesemonger Steve Jenkins explains exactly what makes stinky cheeses stinky. We've a jam tasting, and it's open line for your call. All this and more coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with Kitchen Chronicles, where knowledge is power and cooking is pleasure, a practical guide to nourishing ourselves and the people we care about. Today, let's talk about vinegars, sort of a vinegar primer. The next time you shop, take a look at the market shelves and see how the vinegar sections expanded. Ignoring flavored vinegars for a moment, there are at least four or five different kinds available almost everywhere in the country. Dressing salad is only the beginning of what you can do with the vinegar. For instance, for a great pan sauce, pour a little vinegar in the pan after you've sautéed a piece of fish or vegetables or some meat. For variety, you could add a little garlic or minced ginger to the pan along with the vinegar. Now, boil off all the liquid while you scrape up any crusty bits from the bottom of the pan. Then add a little bit of broth to the pan and boil that down by half. The reduced vinegar gives the sauce depth and an elusive tang. Another cooking trick to know when working with vinegar is that boiling it diminishes its acidity. So when you're doing a hot dressing or a sauce and it's too sharp, just boil it down. A little vinegar accents flavors of foods, especially fruits. Sprinkle a few drops of a nutty-tasting sherry vinegar over ripe pears, then serve them with blue cheese and hazelnuts. Now let's look at the variety of vinegars in the markets and ways of using them. And remember, the best vinegars aren't just acidic. They have distinctive flavors and character. Let's start with cider vinegar. First of all, make sure it's real cider vinegar and not apple-flavored. Use cider vinegar where you want soft, fruity flavors. Try a little of it in apple pie instead of lemon. Red and white wine vinegars. Now, quality here can vary from awful and too acidic to deliciously rich tasting. Look for the Orleans process mentioned on the label. This is a French method that produces a particularly fine vinegar. And always try, if you can, to taste vinegars before you buy them. Use wine vinegars in salad dressings, pan sauces, and to marinate meats along with maybe some olive oil, herbs, and spices. Sherry vinegar. Now, this is made from sherry wine, and when the quality is high, it can taste just like a good sherry with flavors of hazelnuts and dried fruits. Before balsamic vinegar came on the scene, sherry vinegar was the chef's darling. It's superb on salads, especially anything with nuts in them. Try it in pan sauces and baste roasting poultry and game with sherry vinegar. I love to use it in an onion garlic sauté. Take lots and lots of chopped onion and garlic, sauté it in butter and olive oil in a big pan, and keep dribbling a little sherry vinegar into the pan and letting it cook away. Just keep repeating that until the onion tastes rich and lush. Serve it as a side dish or spoon it over grilled seafood. Rice vinegar comes from Asia. It's gentle, mild, and soft tasting, which means it's a great way to cut fat in dressings. You need less oil to balance with the acidity. I like to use it in Asian marinades, and also I marinate shredded daikon radish and carrots in rice vinegar. Tastes great. Malt vinegar is made from unhopped beer with a little caramel added. It's less acidic than most vinegars. I like to use it exactly the way they do in England, sprinkled over fried potatoes or in potato salad or in coleslaw. Balsamic vinegar is the darling of most cooks these days. It falls into two categories. The kind most of us buy is commercial balsamic, usually a blend of wine vinegar and caramel. Now, this is the vinegar you cook with. Put it in marinades, dress salads with it, and if you want to make it richer, add a pinch of brown sugar for every tablespoon of vinegar. True balsamic vinegar comes from only a tiny area of Italy, and it's made by families from simmering down fresh pressed grape juice. Then it's passed through a series of wooden barrels over many years. There's absolutely no wine vinegar in true balsamic vinegar. And what it really becomes is more of a sauce. It's incredibly delicious, and it's used in little quantities on cooked dishes. So, try a new vinegar this week and join us again for Kitchen Chronicles. This week's Splendid Table is a repeat of an earlier broadcast. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show about food, enjoying it, buying it, cooking it, and about eating out, entertaining, health, and travel. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, the only place you can register for kitchen essentials. 1810 stainless steel cookware from Calphalon. It's professional quality, heavy cookware with tempered glass lids and ergonomic handles. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions and is distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. It's that time of year. Friends and families are beginning to gather around the table a bit more regularly, and aren't there always those unexpected undercurrents? Most of us don't realize how much those family meals shape our attitudes toward life. Gourmet magazine editor Ruth Reichel has written a memoir called Tender at the Bone, Growing Up at the Table. It's an account of her early years with food. It all began with a mother who was taste blind. She could not tell if food was spoiled. It made for some very interesting entertaining. Writer Tom McNamee remembers cooking for friends in Death Biryani. Cheese maven Steve Jenkins explains what makes stinky cheeses stinky and then goes on to reveal his favorites. Grocery guru Al Sickerman joins us for a tasting. This week it's raspberry jam. Is there a noticeable difference between a fancy import, a supermarket jam, and an all-fruit one? Stay tuned for this one, guys. And as every week, the second half of the show is all yours, our time to talk. The number is 800-537-5252. Let's get things rolling with Jane and Michael Stern, who roam the country looking for good home-style eating. They write the Two for the Road column in Gourmet Magazine.
You know, Lynn, a few months ago we did a story about steakhouses for Gourmet Magazine, and it was very frustrating because they said to us, only write about steakhouses in big cities. And the truth is that some of the very best steakhouses in this country are way out in the country, far off the beaten path. I'd like to tell you about one of those today. It's in the town of Tea, South Dakota, T-E-A, and the name is the Tea Steakhouse.
Catchy.
It is. And the great thing about this place, other than the motto, which is, we're glad you brought your sugar to tea, is is the fact...
Right there, you can't resist it. Okay, go ahead.
Exactly. I mean, for that alone, we love this place. But it's great because it's a real country steakhouse in the sense that it's not real fancy. People do not necessarily dress up to go there, although they do go there for the big date on Friday or Saturday night. The waitresses are dressed in nylon uniforms and wear orthopedic shoes. The salad is all pure iceberg lettuce in a wood grain plastic bowl. But the steaks are fantastic, delicious, beautiful steaks that you can get either charbroiled or, my favorite way, is grilled in a pan so you get that real good crust on them.
You know, I disagree, Michael. I don't think
You would say this is casual because when we went to the T Steakhouse, I think we got there at 5:30 p.m. on a Friday, and the place, you couldn't get a table because it's all the farmers and ranchers from this area, and this is their big night out, and they're all wearing their best polyester bell-bottom pants and big, you know, belt buckles with the name of their ranch on it, and I mean, they are duded up. They have their hair, you know, vitalist, and the ladies have their big, you know, fried, dyed, and shoved to the side hairdo. I mean, this is the big night out in T, South Dakota.
But now, guys, what makes the great steak in a place like this? I mean, what's the key to this meat?
You know, I honestly do not think it is prime graded steak.
Uh-huh.
What it has that marks a good steak to me is that when you cut into it and take a bite, you suddenly remember why you love steak, because you get that deep, rich beef flavor. And unlike, you know, sort of a fancy big city expense account steakhouse where you get that filet mignon that you could cut with a butter knife,
mm-hmm.
this takes a little bit of chewing, but that chewing rewards you with just tides of that kind of protein richness that you get only from good beef.
I mean, I think it may be prime steak, but as Michael said, I don't know. But whoever is picking out the steak is picking it certainly for flavor. And there's also just something so wonderful about this place that's in the middle of nowhere. I mean, the town of T, I don't know, it looks like it has 100 people in it.
I should mention parenthetically that there is one other interesting culinary business in the town of T, which is Lee's Smokehouse, which serves primarily hunters. In other words, if you bring them your deer, elk, or
mm-hmm.
javelina,
mm-hmm.
they will turn it into steaks, chops, snacks, sticks, whatever you want.
It's javelina. You didn't grow up in Tucson, Michael.
The javelina, whatever.
Javelina? Wait a minute.
Pig.
It's a wild pig.
Oh, okay. All
right. They'll make it into sausage. They'll make it. And the great thing that you can get there, which we got a bunch of to take with us as we left the town of T, is beef jerky. There's nothing like good, real beef jerky. If all you've ever eaten is those things you get in a convenience store,
you haven't had
beef jerky.
And Michael loved this so much, he asked the guy who ran the place if they did mail order, and he said, "I'm sorry, sir, we don't, so please don't send me your carcass through the mail. We can't dress it and send it back to you."
So Michael's carcass is staying right where it is.
Yeah, right where he left it.
I'm not going to bite on that one.
Hey,
thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye, Len.
If you're feeling fancy free, come wander to the world with me. And any place we chance to be will be our rendezvous. Two for the road.
Jane and Michael Stern are authors of Eat Your Way Across the USA and Chili Nation. You can hear them every week on The Splendid Table. You can find their restaurant discoveries on our website at splendidtable.org. I love obsessive people, at least when they're obsessing about something I'm interested in. Steve Jenkins is obsessed with cheese and has been for over 20 years. He imports cheeses and he sells them, and he's the author of Steve Jenkins' Cheese Primer. He comes by the Splendid Table often to share his treasures and to answer our questions. Steve, today I want to talk to you about stinky cheeses.
Oh, my favorites.
Well, what makes a cheese stinky?
Stinky cheeses are the cheese classification that we refer to as washed rind. Most delicious cheeses in the world. The rinds are actually washed with some liquid, be it water or brine or beer or wine or brandy or whatever, hard cider. What happens is that liquid feeds the bacteria that are on the outside of that cheese, and they ferment. The whole surface of that cheese begins to ferment, and the result is an enormous amount of odor, or in my case, aroma. It smells good to me.
Now, does that permeate the cheese? I mean, am I actually tasting that in the cheese?
It has a great deal of effect on how the interior is going to taste. Yes, indeed, it does.
Everybody seems to make a stinky cheese. I mean, I think a lot of countries make them.
Oh, yeah.
And I have no doubt you've got some favorites. What are some of the ones you really like?
Oh, God, that's so hard for me because they're all my favorites.
I didn't think this was going to be easy.
Yeah, I can pull about a 15 out of the air off the top of my head. Reblochon from Savoie.
Right.
That gorgeous region south of Geneva, Switzerland, that's on the French side of the border. Reblochon referring to milk again, when the farmer would pay taxes with milk, and he'd say the cow's empty, and the tax man would go away, and then he'd furiously finish milking the cow. The result is he'd get the richest milk of the whole milking, and he'd go make these little discs of raw cow's milk cheese for himself. In order to make them really flavorful, he would rub the rind with either some white wine or just some brine twice a day for the next 2 weeks. And then after a month, he would remove, 2 months, he would remove that cheese from the ripening room, and it would have this huge, wonderful aroma and have this real glistening, runny interior and an enormous flavor. Ooh, what a cheese Reblochon from France.
I'm ready for it. All right.
Oh, yeah.
What others?
Well, I hesitate to say Gorgonzola because everybody knows Gorgonzola as sort of a blue cheese that you cube into salad or will be tossed with pasta. But, you know, Gorgonzola is a washed rind cheese. It's very, very smelly cheese, and it's unique in that it's the blue cheese that it's the only one that has its rind washed. And the result is just like a cheese that isn't a blue. It's got an orangish, brownish, reddish crust that's very moist and highly aromatic, and the inside is as strong as the outside.
Another one.
Appenzeller from Switzerland.
Oh.
From the three of the easternmost cantons in Switzerland comes the famous Swiss cheese known as Appenzeller. And Appenzeller really falls outside our washed rind classification because its curd has been cooked and pressed, which makes it semi-firm. Nonetheless, the most endearing attribute of Appenzeller is that the outside of the cheese through its ripening period is frequently washed by hand with a secret wine mixture of white wine mixed with herbs and spices, alpine herbs and some kind of spices. They've divulged it, but not very many people know what this secret mixture is. Appenzeller is, you know, it's a key ingredient in a Swiss fondue. Just a little bit of Appenzeller makes a Swiss fondue just excruciatingly delicious.
Mm. Got another one that you really love?
Yeah, I just... I'm crazy about Belgian Hervé, but you can't get it here. Hervé, H-E-R-V-E. Man, that's probably the smelliest cheese in the world. Actually, no. You know, I would say Maroilles, M-A-R-O-I-L-L-E-S, from the north of France, from Thiérache, Flanders, Artois, Picardy. In fact, they call it Il Point, the stinker. It's a square cow's milk cheese that's washed with white wine, sometimes with beer in this area, but it depends on the cheesemaker, what he or she likes the most. That's got to be the smelliest cheese in the world. Oh, my Lord. Even smellier than Hervé.
Now, where does Limburger stand with all of these?
Well, Limburger is the cheese that your dad or your granddad remembers as being, you know, one of those life experiences. The reality is that Limburger is boring cheese. It's mass-produced in factories in Germany and in Ohio and Minnesota and Illinois. And it's, once again, falls into our classic classification of washed rind cheeses, but it's made from dead milk, i.e. pasteurized milk that has no merit, no integrity whatsoever.
Uh-huh.
And it's smelly, but there's no flavor to the inside of the cheese. You cut the rind away, there'd be a phantom lying on the plate.
Uh-huh. What do we drink with these cheeses?
First, if you're a wine person, it's got to be a big red. A Pinot Noir will be overwhelmed by any one of these washed rind cheeses, even though I think the greatest cheese in the world after Parmesan, Epoisse from Burgundy, is from Burgundy and is meant to go with the Pinot Noirs, which I find peculiar because it's too big for Pinot Noirs.
Uh-huh.
This requires Tempranillo grape, Cabernet grapes, Sangiovese grapes, big, big, rough tannic red wines. I love a fresh cider. I love fresh apple cider. And, you know, apple cider can have a little bit of a kick, a little bit of alcohol. It can have about as much as wine, like 12 to 14%. Or it can be Calvados, which is brandy that's made from apples. And brandy is a great thing to serve with washed rind cheeses.
What about beer? Would that work with...
Oh, beer is fabulous with washed rind cheeses. The great Trappist cheeses of Belgium were invented by these Trappist monks to go with the beer that they made on the premises as well.
So we have a lot of choices. Hey, Steve,
oh, boy,
thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Only the B-52s could have a lyric with Limburger in them. We've been waiting to use this one a long, long time.
Steve Jenkins is author of Steve Jenkins Cheese Primer. You can find Steve's cheese selections on our website at splendidtable.org, and you can find Steve behind the counter of Fairway Markets in New York. Coming up, Gourmet Magazine editor Ruth Reichel remembers mommy food, death biryani, and your calls. Get on the line at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, distributed by PRI Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Target, dedicated to helping you discover new and exciting ideas that help you enjoy everything there is about cooking for your friends and family, just like you do here at The Splendid Table each week. Find them online at Target.com. It's the time of year when families get together around a table a bit more often. How we experience this as children shapes a lot of our attitudes toward food later in life. It can even shape careers. Today we're talking to Ruth Reichel, editor of Gourmet Magazine. Ruth has written a memoir, Tender at the Bone. Ruth's life has been shaped by mealtimes. I asked her, was there one person who influenced you the most?
Yes, it was my mother, who was totally taste blind. And because of her taste blindness, I really did focus on food. I mean, partly out of self-defense. I mean, my mother inadvertently poisoned people all the time. the first story in the book is about her throwing this party for my brother's engagement and putting 26 people in the hospital, his future in-laws among them.
What did she do?
My mother, one, really couldn't taste when things were bad, and two, had complete indifference to spoiled food. I mean, there's also this story in the book about my mother waking my father up one morning and having him come down to the kitchen and tasting something. My father was very sleepy, and she put this thing in his mouth, and he said it was the single worst thing he had ever tasted. And he finally couldn't swallow it. He spit it out and put the coffee pot, the whole spout of the coffee pot, in his mouth to try and get rid of this terrible taste. And my mother sort of crossed her arms and said, just as I thought, spoiled.
Now, so she had no sense of this.
She had asked him to taste it because she really couldn't tell whether it was spoiled or not. And she also didn't understand that, you know, when there was mold on things, one of my early memories is watching her go through the refrigerator, scraping the blue stuff off and saying, oh, a little mold never hurt anyone, and serving it. And if you have a mother like that, you have one of two responses. One is you never want anything to do with food, or two, you decide that you will take over the food in the house.
And that's what you did?
And that's what I did. The cover of the book is me cooking at 7. And I love this picture. It's a picture my dad took, because you can see that I'm very serious. This is not, I'm not playing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm cooking dinner for the family. And I did that. And the other quality that my mother had about food was she was very curious. She had a real intellectual curiosity. So when she would go to the market and see something that she'd never seen before, she would bring it back, and we would try and figure out what to do with it. So at the same time that I'm sort of like, you know, learning to cook in self-defense, I'm also getting mussels and cactus flowers and sea urchins are coming into the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a wonderful thing for a kid to have this sense that everybody was grateful when I cooked, because God knows it was better than what Mom made. And I never had any sense of failure. You know, I mean, never had a sense that it might not work out.
You mean just went at it?
I just sort of went at it, and it's a great way to learn to cook because everybody's always saying, oh, isn't it great? You know, she's made dinner, this little girl. And you learn to cook before you realize that you could make mistakes. Nobody ever said, oh, this is awful, I can't eat this.
Was anybody teaching you at all?
Well, I did have the great good fortune to be around a lot of wonderful cooks who were not my mother. One was my Aunt Bertie's maid, Alice, who could cook anything. And I spent a lot of time with them, and she would entertain me from the time that I was like 4 or 5 by saying, you know, pick a dish. And I would look at Aunt Bertie's wedding menu and say, you know, let's make this, fried oysters or chicken croquettes or turtle soup. And Alice and I would go to the grocery store, and I saw that her enormous knowledge about food gave her power. In the grocery store, nobody would give her anything but the very best food. And, you know, I watched this woman, and they were living in a not very good neighborhood. She was a black woman. And she would stroll through these stores like a queen, and people would sort of cower, and the butcher would, you know, you'd see him rejecting all the cuts that weren't good enough for Alice, and he would finally hold out the very best cut like a jewel. And I noticed that Aunt Bertie, who was her employer, who was not a cook, couldn't cook at all, she'd go to the store and they'd just give her any old thing. And I thought, well, okay, you know, knowledge is power. And then Alice and I would go home with these precious ingredients that she had bought, and she would make whatever we had chosen and show me how to do it. And we would spend the whole afternoon cooking.
Would you read us something from the book?
Absolutely. Most mornings I got out of bed and went to the refrigerator to see how my mother was feeling. You could tell instantly just by opening the door. One day in 1960, I found a whole suckling pig staring at me. I jumped back and slammed the door, hard. Then I opened it again. I'd never seen a whole animal in our refrigerator before. Even the chickens came in parts. He was surrounded by tiny crab apples, lady apples, my mother corrected me later, and a whole wreath of weird vegetables. This was not a bad sign. The more odd and interesting things that were in the refrigerator, the happier my mother was likely to be. Still, I was puzzled. The refrigerator in our small kitchen had been almost empty when I went to bed. Where did you get all this stuff? I asked. The stores aren't open yet. Oh, said Mom blithely, patting at her crisp gray hair. I woke up early and decided to go for a walk. You'd be surprised at what goes on in Manhattan at 4 a.m. I've been down to the Fulton Fish Market. I found the most interesting produce store on Bleecker Street. It was open? I asked. Well, she admitted, not really. She walked across the worn linoleum and set a basket of bread on the formica table. But I saw someone moving around, so I knocked. I've been trying to get ideas for the party. Party? I asked warily. What party? Your brother has decided to get married, she said casually, as if I should have somehow intuited this in my sleep. And of course we're going to have a party to celebrate the engagement and meet Shelley's family. My brother, I knew, would not welcome this news. He was 13 years older than I and considered it a minor miracle to have reached the age of 25. I don't know how I survived her cooking, he said, as he was telling me about the years when he and Mom were living alone, after she had divorced his father and was waiting to meet mine. She's a menace to society. Bob went to live with his father in Pittsburgh right after I was born, but he always came home for holidays. When he was there, he always helped me protect the guests, using tact to keep them from eating the more dangerous items. I took a more direct approach. Don't eat that, I ordered my best friend Jeannie as her spoon dipped into one of Mom's more creative lunch dishes. My mother believed in celebrating every holiday. In honor of St. Patrick, she was serving bananas with green sour cream. I don't mind the color, said Jeannie, a trusting soul whose own mother wouldn't dream of offering you an all-orange Halloween extravaganza complete with milk dyed the color of orange juice. Ida served the sort of perfect lunches that I longed for. Neat squares of cream cheese and jelly on white bread, bologna sandwiches, Chef Boyardee straight from the can. It's not just food coloring, I said. The sour cream was green to begin with. The carton's been in the refrigerator for months. Jeannie quickly put her spoon down, and when Mom went into the other room to answer the phone, we ducked into the bathroom and flushed our lunches down the toilet. "That was great, Mim," said Jeannie when Mom returned. "May we be excused," is all I said. I wanted to get away from the table before anything else appeared. "Don't you want dessert?" Mom asked. "Sure," said Jeannie. "No," I said. But Mom had already gone to get the cookies. She returned with some strange black lumps on a plate. Jeannie looked at them dubiously, then politely picked one up. "Oh, go ahead, eat it," I said, reaching for one myself. "They're just Girl Scout mint cookies. She left them on the radiator so all the chocolate melted off, but they won't kill you."
Ruth, what kind of person defines their life with food?
Well, I actually think lots of us do. One of the things that's happened with this whole emphasis that we have on food these days is that people have been thinking about recipes and does it taste good. And one of the things I really wanted to do in the book is talk about what I think is the more important part of food, which is how it brings us all together and what it says about people. And, you know, there's something about cooks. There's one of the things that I love so much about food is that great cooks are very generous people, and there's this wonderful quality of giving. And that's an aspect of food that I think people are now really starting to think about. You know, why is this wonderful? Well, it's wonderful because it's a way of people expressing love.
Ruth, thank you.
Thank you.
Home is where
Ruth Reichel is restaurant critic for the New York Times and author of Tender at the Bone, Growing Up at the Table. Most of us have cooked for friends at one time or another. We all love that warm, fuzzy idea of everyone coming together around the table to celebrate our gift to them. Writer Tom McNamee remembers a meal kind of like that.
Death Biryani, New York City, 1981. I was already in Dutch with Mark and Rhonda Singer. They had invited us to Sunday brunch at their apartment, and we had gratefully accepted, and then we completely spaced it and didn't show up. We didn't even realize it until days later. So this Indian dinner I was making for them had to be good. I was a pretty experienced cook by then, and I'd eaten a lot of Indian food in New York, ranging from the elegance of Gaylord and Raga in Midtown to the Don't Ask Vindaloos of the Modern Indian Restaurant and Seafood Cuisine, Inc. in the East Village, where it was nighttime all day and the lunch waiter contemplated suicide at a back table as we moaned for the check. But I was just beginning to explore the complex subtleties of actually cooking Indian dishes, and I had discovered no dish more subtly sublime than biryani. I loved the fact that you create two whole different dishes and marry them only at the end, when the saffron pilaf, bejeweled with sultanas and cashews, receives the yogurt-sticky chicken like a secret lover, and you close them tight in the hot dark together till their steam bursts forth. Indian food is a lot of work. The chopping, the mortar and pestling, the long, slow cooking of the onion and ginger to golden sweetness. The prep work takes hours when you're making a big multi-dish dinner like this one, which included a mint raita, a red lentil dal, and more. Naturally, a glass of wine helps pass the time. And if your kitchen is so small that when your chopping board slips sideways a little, you knock your wine glass into the sink, well, that's nothing new. You just pick up the pieces and chuck them in the wastebasket next to the stove and keep prepping. At least it didn't seem like a big deal until Rhonda, seated as guest of honor on my right, stopped chewing in a peculiar kind of very still way, peculiar enough that the rest of us stopped talking and just goggled as she opened wide and removed from her mouth a 2-inch-long, dagger-pointed slice of glass. She had not bitten down on it and driven it through the roof of her mouth into her brain. And she insisted, as I chased her and Mark down 9th Street, that she really, really accepted my apology. Really, Tom, really.
Tom McNamee is author of The Return of the Wolf to Yellowstone. The essay Death Biryani first appeared in Savoir magazine. It's that time. We are taking your calls this hour. The lines are open. Let's talk. The number is 1-800-537-5252. Anything that you want to talk about, we'll give it a shot. Let's get started. We've got Elizabeth on the line. Hi, Elizabeth. What's up?
Hi. Hello. My question concerns pasta and, this is going to sound kind of bad, but bugs.
Together?
Yeah.
Are you working on a new pasta dish?
No, not intentionally.
Okay. What do you mean, though?
Well, when I buy boxed pasta from the grocery store, even the higher end, you know, the fancier ones.
Right.
You know, I keep a few different kinds of pasta in my cupboard all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like probably three or four times it's happened to me where I've gone and opened a box, usually one that had already been opened. But to find, sometimes not until I actually had the water boiling, that there were little worm-like bugs inside there with the pasta.
And this is usually in boxes you've already opened?
Usually, but one time it wasn't.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and I don't have any bugs in my cupboard. Of course, I took everything out. And
I'm avoiding the wisecrack of now you have protein with your carbohydrates. I'm not going to do that.
Well, I know the USDA, like, supposedly allows so many parts per million of bug legs and stuff.
That's a very high part per million. That's like umpteen gazillion times per million. Are you shopping in a particular place? Because I have to tell you, you can imagine how much pasta, you know, has been consumed in my house. I have never seen that in a box of pasta. I think there's a couple of things. First of all, where are you shopping?
Well, I shop at one of really probably the most expensive grocery store in town.
That doesn't mean they've got great turnover, though. I wonder. Has this happened with stuff you've bought from them repeatedly?
No, only this type of product.
Only this kind of product. Okay, a couple of things. Different brands of pasta, by the way, or
yes,
just one?
Yes, different brands.
Boy. First of all, you may have something in your house. Now, don't be offended.
I won't.
No, don't be offended. And I'm going to tell you a quick story. This is my way of saying to you, it happens to the best of us. I have a cupboard where I keep all my exotic stuff, and I seal it all in plastic, and I keep cleaning that cupboard. And at one point, I went to clean out a whole plastic container of Indian ingredients. And when I opened the top of the plastic, out flew creatures. I mean, you would have thought we were remaking a horror movie. The only thing that didn't come out of that box were bats. And I am an immaculate, obsessive cleaner of my kitchen. And the fact is that sometimes there are dormant beasties. And, you know, when they're sitting there long enough, something happens. But I would say, first of all, maybe you may want to not shop at that store. Secondly, I would, when you take the pasta out, you know, when you open the box, you use half a pound of the pasta, mm-hmm. put it in a sealed plastic bag or in a jar, mm-hmm. just so it's sealed. And that way you probably will avoid, if there happens to be any sort of hiding creatures in your cupboards, they're not going to get in. The other thing to do is to make sure pasta boxes usually aren't marked for freshness, but you want to buy them in places where there's a fair amount of turnover.
Okay.
And, of course, once you find anything in a pasta box, don't use the pasta.
Right. No.
Just don't take a chance.
No.
Yeah. I mean, it's because your part per million counts really up there.
Yeah.
It's an unusual problem. I've not heard of it before, but certainly we've seen it with other foods. It sometimes happens.
Okay. Well,
change your place where you are shopping.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay.
Worms. Now, there is a pasta out there that everybody's heard about that actually means little worms. Vermicelli translates as little worms. And by the way, ziti, you know the hollow pasta, the long hollow pasta? Bridegrooms. I'm just going to leave that. Okay, it's time for the trivia question of the week, and here it is. What's the name of the song by Lyle Lovett where the saxophone section of a band playing at a wedding is poisoned? There's a bonus in it for you if you can come up with the name of the person who did the dirty deed. Mull that one over. We'll be back in a minute with more of your calls at 1-800-537-5252 and the answer to our weekly trivia challenge. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. We're taking your calls this hour at 1-800-537-5252, but before going back to the phones, I've got the answer to our trivia challenge of the week. The question was, what's the name of the song by Lyle Lovett where the saxophone section of a band playing at a wedding is poisoned? Have a listen.
And it was a highbrow occasion for no special reason, and nobody knew, said nobody knew, that the flowers were furnished by the funeral parlor, and the whole thing was paid for by the funeral director who poisoned the saxophone section.
The song title is An Acceptable Level of Ecstasy, and obviously the funeral director did in the musicians. Okay, back to your calls. Again, the number is 1-800-537-5252. Let's see, we've got Sarah on the line. Hi, Sarah.
Hi there, how are you?
I'm fine.
What I wanted to know is poached pears without red wine, if I'm just wanting to do them light and even non-alcoholic.
Well, you could poach them in a vanilla syrup.
Okay.
You could take a couple of vanilla beans and split them.
Okay.
And maybe take the zest of half of an orange, just the colored part.
Good.
And if you want to, you could even add some spices.
Okay.
And then make a syrup of, I'd say probably one part sugar to two parts water.
Okay.
And simmer that for about 15 minutes and then put the pears in there.
Perfect.
Okay, and all you want to do is have enough liquid to submerge the pears, more or less.
Got it. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay, bye-bye.
Take care. Jay's calling. Hi, Jay. What's up?
My wife and I have been married almost 2 years.
Congratulations.
Thank you. We've moved from Ohio to Utah, and this is our first Easter not having dinner with family, and we'd like to make our own ham. And we were wondering if you have a good recipe that we could use to create something special.
Oh, boy, there's a lot of stuff you can do with a ham. I mean, a ham is one of those things that it's like having a canvas. You can paint anything you'd like on it.
Uh-huh.
I tend to favor country hams, but they're kind of hard to get a hold of the last minute because you usually have to mail order them. But you could take a good ham, and one of the things you can do is to stuff it. And the way you do that is buy a small ham.
Okay.
Okay. And take your knife and cut down toward the center of the ham. I'll take a long-bladed knife, and then cut sort of in a spiral.
Okay.
Now make a mixture of sautéed onion, toasted nuts, and what's really delicious would be something like toasted almonds.
Okay.
With currants or raisins and a bit of garlic. And if you'd like, maybe a pinch of black pepper and an herb that you might like. For instance, I love basil. Then again,
okay.
I love basil in everything.
And what you do is just stuff that into the cuts that you made. And then all you want to do is then cook the ham, and usually most of these hams are cooked through to begin with, so you're just heating them through. But still, that means you're going to take the ham at about 325 for maybe 10 minutes to the pound to get it hot all the way through. And if you want, you could glaze it with a combination of something like maybe port wine and a dry white wine,
okay,
which is really a nice way to do it. Or if you don't want any alcohol, you could glaze it with a little bit of apple juice. And when I say glaze, I don't mean something sticky and gooey. I mean you're basting it,
okay,
with apple cider or apple juice, which will just give it a nice sheen. How does that sound?
That sounds really good. Now, this stuffing, that's actually being put inside each of those spiral pieces?
That's right. Well, you're going to stuff it. You're going to make this long spiral cut into the ham, and then you're going to stuff it with this mixture. The other nut that's lovely in that is pistachio because of the green color.
Okay.
You'd want salted pistachio nuts for that, though.
Okay.
All right?
Sounds good.
Okay. Give that a try. See what you think of it.
Will do. Thank you for your help.
Oh, you're welcome. I mentioned I love country hams, and if you can get your hands on something like a Colonel Newsom ham from Kentucky or a real Smithfield, these are hams that usually need soaking, and then they're poached, and then they're served at room temperature, but they're delicious. They're a whole different experience in hams. So maybe next year when you can plan ahead, think about trying a country ham. Any food magazine is going to have, right around springtime, a whole listing in the back of, you know, people advertising country hams. As I said, Colonel Newsom is one of the ones I like. Edwards hams, by the way, from Smithfield County in Virginia, are also great. Ken is calling. Ken, hi. What's happening?
Hi. I'm a science teacher at in Eugene, Oregon, and we are in Brain Awareness Week. I've had some people come in and talk about neurology and the makeup of the brain, and like to cook up some brain. I've done in the past, but have not found a real good recipe, and
uh-huh,
was hoping you could help me.
What is the class? What age group is this?
It's a life science class. It's a seventh grade class, and it's just something extra I like to do for the kids. We don't eat brain too often, and give an opportunity to try something different, and hopefully without the mad cow disease.
Well, this I can't guarantee one way or the other, obviously.
Okay.
Brains used to be a delicacy.
Yes.
The French love them, and I'm going to tell you the French way of making them. I think this is really great. You're doing this with kids in seventh grade?
Yeah.
Do you do a lot of this kind of thing with the kids?
I try to make it hands-on and edible, or a little more exciting than just reading out of a book anytime possible.
It's good to hear. This is the way you treat brains. First of all, people seem to favor the brains of young animals rather than older animals. So calf and lamb versus, let's say, sheep and beef. The thing you want to do first is to soak the brains.
All right.
And you usually need to soak them, if it's from a young animal, about an hour in cold water in the refrigerator. And then what ends up happening is you then clean the filaments, because you know what a brain looks like.
Yes.
Obviously. There's a lot of filament between the lobes of the brain and the sections of the brain, and you want to get rid of any blood and any sort of ragtag pieces of filament. The next step is you lightly poach the brains, and this firms them up. And this is done by taking something like, you could even use canned chicken broth that you add a little bit of vinegar to. You want a little acid, evidently that helps the firming process. And you would very gently, not letting the water really bubble, just having it shudder, or the liquid bubble, rather,
right,
cook the brains about 20 minutes or until they're just firm. Now, at that point, you could chill them, or you could just go on with the recipe. From here on in, you can do anything you want. And I'll tell you one of the best ways to deal with this kind of thing that the kids will really love is to fry them.
Right.
Anything you fry, people are going to enjoy eating.
Okay.
This is a basic premise. Fry it and they will come. So this is, but it's true. I mean, think about it. Anything you fry, everybody goes crazy over.
Right.
So what you can do is dip it in some beaten egg and roll it in either breadcrumbs or seasoned flour and then pan fry it in butter, or you could use something like a canola oil until it's crusty and crunchy on the outside. And I do pieces that are maybe about 2 inches across.
All right.
And see how they like it.
All right.
No one's asked about brains in probably at least two decades.
And you probably won't have another call for a long time.
I think you're right. I think we have covered this issue probably sufficiently for, well, maybe the next decade.
There you go.
Hey, but thank you.
Thank you very much, Lynn. Bye.
There's another point here about, you know, what to do with foods that people are leery of. I'm just thinking back about how brains are prepared and sweetbreads and kidneys. And there seems to be two basic approaches. Sauté them or fry them until they're real crusty on the outside, and then nobody cares what's going on the inside. And the other way is that you lightly sauté these things so they're cooked through. And then you make a pan sauce, and most of the time it involves things like heavy cream and a coarse, strong-tasting mustard, and maybe a little white wine. You'd boil down the white wine, and then you'd stir in the mustard, and then you'd simmer in a little bit of cream. Now, when you put those three things together, they're generally going to make almost anything taste good. So whenever you're in doubt about selling somebody on a weird food, and I think today we do think of brains as being weird, go for the mustard, the cream, and the white wine, or fry it. Hey, thanks everybody for calling in. Remember, you can call us anytime, day or night. The number is 1-800-537-5252. Al Sickerman is food and humor columnist for the Star Tribune newspaper in Minneapolis. He's a grocery store guru. Al wanders the grocery aisles, evaluating what's new in the market and telling his readers about it. He stops by the Splendid Table once a month to bring in supermarket stuff for me to taste. It's a way of kind of keeping me grounded in the real world. So, hi, Al.
Hi, Lynn. How are you?
I'm fine. What have you brought today?
Well, I brought some raspberry jam of sorts. Three different kinds, not just three different brands, three different sorts of product. Because a great deal of emphasis these days in fruit juices, too, and jams is on not adding sugar or being all fruit or something like that. 100% juice, 100% in this case fruit.
Uh-huh.
And 100% fruit doesn't taste very good. 100% of raspberries in raspberry jam would taste like raspberries. It's not jam. Jam has sugar in it.
Mm-hmm.
And to put sugar in jam that you want to sell as 100% fruit, what you do is you use, instead of fruit, you use fruit juice. If you pick up a jar of Kraft raspberry jam, the first ingredient is raspberries. If you pick up a jar of any of the 100% fruit products, the first ingredient is fruit juice and then raspberries. Because fruit juice isn't as sweet as high fructose corn syrup that folks like Kraft would normally throw into jam, so you have to use even more of it. And it doesn't taste like raspberries, it's just fruit juice, usually pretty flavorless fruit juice. So, I have brought along three things here. One is plain orange jam of somebody's.
Right.
One is somebody's 100% fruit version, the same somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And one is a very expensive imported raspberry jam.
All right, I'm going to dig in.
Before you taste them, Lynn, I want to leave the room so I can tell people which ones you're tasting while you're tasting them.
I'm going to be left all by myself. I hate this. I need company. Okay, looking at the first bowl, this is the jam looks very firm. I mean, it's standing up kind of on its own, and it's flecked with seeds, and it's a dark garnet red.
Number one is Smucker's Red Raspberry Preserves.
It's very sweet. It has a hint of tartness. This is hard. I don't know blindfolded if I would think that number one was raspberry. I got sort of something tart and something sweet, something that tasted fruity, but I don't get raspberry screaming at me. Okay, jam number two. This one is a brownish red, and it is softer than the first one. It's jam-like, but it has moisture in it. It just seems a little bit more puddly. Not unappealing, by the way. Okay. Oh.
Number two is Smucker's Simply 100% Fruit. Oh. Spreadable fruit.
The first jam broke apart. You tasted sweet, and then you tasted tart, and kind of got some sense of fruit. This is more, the flavors are bound together. It's quite a rich-tasting jam. Again, blindfolded, would I know this was raspberry? I'm not sure, but it's an appealing flavor. It just tastes whole. It tastes wonderfully fruity. I like this jam, and I think it's a little less sweet than the first one. Jam number three. Oh, this is the most liquid of all of them. it's not stiff at all. It's quite lovely, and it's kind of loose. It has a nice luster. It looks a little cloudy, but it's a nice, dark, lush red color. Okay, let's see what we've got here.
Oh. Number three is Francis Mio's Gold Medal Imported Raspberry Jam.
My. It's done the same thing as the first one did. You get sweet, and then you get a lot more tart. Could there be a truer taste of raspberry here? I don't really think so. I almost feel like this would be great to fill a tart with because it's not wildly sweet, has a nice fruity quality. Maybe I'm getting a tad more raspberry. I would say it's hard for me. Number one is out. Number one is definitely not my favorite. It's either number two or number three. I'm going to go back and taste number two just for a second. Number three is my favorite. That's it. Al, come on. Tell me what I've been eating.
Well, okay, Lynn. Number one was Smucker's Red Raspberry Preserves, straight out of the preserve patch, the way people normally have been selling preserves.
Right.
Number two was Smucker's Simply 100% Fruit,
okay,
which is first ingredient is clarified white grape juice concentrate. And number three is an imported product that I actually did not buy. It's the producer's husband's favorite. Gold Medal Francis Mio, M-I-O-T, raspberry jam. The ingredients in order of descent are raspberries, cane sugar, and lemon juice.
That's really, I'm very surprised because I believe that a lot of the very fancy jams are not necessarily living up to, you know, what we hope of them. But
let me throw in one other aspect. The two Smucker's product cost, in essence, the same amount, about 17 cents an ounce.
Okay, what's the other one?
The imported one costs about 70 cents an ounce, about five times as much.
Five times as much? I don't think it was five times better. The gold medal, whatever it was, import was very nice, but it wasn't five times better than the Smucker's,
yeah,
whatever,
it's
pure
$8.50 fruit. A jar.
Yeah.
No.
$8.50 a jar?
Well, the producer, you know, I mean, she takes home a bundle.
In my humble opinion, of which I have not had one since I was nine, I'm sorry, $8.50 for a jar of jam, unless, I mean, the angels were singing when it was made. It's just not worth it. No, I'd go with number two. I'd go with the pure fruit Smucker's any day. And even number one wasn't bad. I mean, I just think that the number two was tastier.
Okie doke.
Thank you, Al.
Thank you.
That's it for today, folks. Thanks for being with us. Do join us next week. In the meantime, let me leave you with a little ditty from 18th century England that dealt head-on with the problem of how to eat peas without rolling them all over the place. And I quote, "I eat my peas with honey. I've done it all my life. It makes my peas taste funny, but it keeps them on my knife." Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, where couples choose the gifts they want and find the things they need. Club Wed is one of the largest bridal registries in the country. Online at Target.com. To get a copy of the Stearns Roadside Food Finds and information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to the Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's the Splendid Table, care of MPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or take a look at our website at splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift. Our associate producers are Jennifer Lubke and Jennifer Russell. The theme music is by Billy Barber. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Bakley Productions. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Public Radio International.